When the subject was first announced a couple of weeks ago, I guess I started getting emails or people perhaps who were just familiar with the work of Dr. Shelley Kerr. And some of the emails were telling me how much they're looking forward to hearing her. And one or two people said, aren't you a little bit scared of this topic? You know, divination of God. You know, aren't people of faith warned away from ever trying to divine the will of God, to hire somebody who will do this sort of work? Well, fair enough. I guess I won't settle that question tonight, nor am I interested terribly after reading this book, because of what Dr. Shelley Kerr has put together, which I think is a very reasonable and well-researched argument for a device that could be made that would follow a blueprint from the Bible on how we, theoretically, could get yes or no answers from God. Wouldn't that just be amazing if just for a few bucks you could make one of these on your own? We'll tell you all about it coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. If you were on a long bus trip across the country and you happen to sit down next to Dr. Shelley Kerr, there's a lot of different ways the conversation could go. I'll choose just one or two of the many options tonight, but we'll focus on the information in the book, Divination of God. You can find out more about her by linking up to her at coasttocoastam.com. And thank you so much, Dr. Shelley Kerr. Hope you're having a wonderful evening wherever you are.
I am. And how are you?
I couldn't be better. I love this idea, though, and I've been trying to sort it out exactly what it means. As you're traveling the U.S. and abroad, lecturing and conducting thousands of past life, I get that part, but also future memory journeys through hypnosis. What's a future memory journey?
I do a lot of future progressions with people.
What does that mean?
I put people into a state of hypnosis, and then instead of taking them into the past, I have them imagine that they're floating up over a timeline where they can actually float out into their future. And so I have them imagine that they're going to the place where they're very successful and happy and things are really working out for them. And then once they get there to that future event, then I have them say, well, that's great, Ian, so how did you get there? And then they start telling me step by step the way that they created this blissful peace. And then, you know, I'm a big believer that we're going to get what we think about. And so by experiencing that firsthand, then they're more likely to create what it is that they want to create instead of what's happening to them or whatever.
I totally get that. That's very interesting. In fact, let me play that out just by saying, I talk to people sometimes and I talk about their careers and I ask them, you know, if you could paint a picture of whatever you want to doing wherever it is that you want to do, wherever you want to do it, and I ask them that way, then it's always interesting to see what people sort of imagine their life to be. But you're actually saying go beyond just that image and actually kind of walk around it hypnotically.
Yeah, it's the same thing you're doing, just putting them, but then taking it a little bit further by putting them into a trance state. So they're
right
in the deeply receptive state of learning where they can really internalize that. And then once they get there, I'll talk to them and I'll say, now I want you to really tune into this feeling. What does it feel like to be so successful? And
right,
what are people saying to you? And they'll really get involved in it. And then, you know, if we think about the laws of quantum physics that say just by observing something, then we're more likely to create that. Then we know that, people can create their wildest dreams, I think.
Well, I think that's very interesting. Now, is it always about success financially?
Not necessarily. I don't think that abundance and success have anything to do with money, really.
Right.
I mean, it's more about finding their peace. I do a lot of different kinds of counseling, and a lot of times people will come in and they'll say, which kind of does get into the topic we're going to talk about tonight. People, they need direction, and they go, you know, I know I'm supposed to be doing something, but I'm just
right,
not quite getting what that is. And I really believe that within each one of us, you know, as we tap into that higher wisdom that we all have access to, that we really do have the answers to those questions.
Oh, I totally get that. And in this case, the idea of future memory journeys, then you're doing more than just having them kind of work up a 5-year plan. You're having them, right? I mean, that's what a lot of people would do. But you're having kind of go and seeing what they were and then like kind of work backward from there. Are there people that when you talk to them casually before hypnosis have a very different image of what their life would mean, you know, what their life would look like if they were happy and living with abundance when they actually go under hypnosis? Does their image of themselves happy and living in abundance change?
Yeah, the thing is, usually when they come in, it's real intuitive work, so everybody's different. But normally what I'll do is I'll start by taking them into the past, whether that's in the past lives or whether that's in the past to their childhood, to either remember their inner gifts or to heal and forgive and let go of things that they have to let go of, because sometimes they can't go out into that happy place until something else is addressed in the past. And then I have them meet with a guide or angel or whatever, however it is that they create that in their mind, who helps them and who comes and tells them, you know, what is your purpose? What are you on this planet for at this time? And so then once they're armed with this knowledge of, you know, who they've been, what they're letting go of, who they are at a higher purpose level, then they go out into the future. So it's kind of like a whole journey.
Well, you know, and I'm so glad you're doing that. I think there are a lot of people that would enjoy that process. I remember when I first went to college, my first advisor sat me down and said, "Why are you here? Go away." And he was really serious. And he said, you know, most people go to college for all the wrong reasons. And I had to kind of convince him that I wanted to get a degree in English literature because I really felt I wanted it in order to do what I wanted to do. But he said, you know, you have no idea how many people come in and they say their life work is to someday swim with dolphins, but they're studying accounting, you know, and they have nothing. What they do has no connection to what they want to do.
Right.
And so I'm glad you're doing that. And so it is a good tie-in to the idea of divination of God, as the subtitle reads on the book, "The Obscure Ancient Tool of Prophecy Revealed." Well, sort of revealed under our noses the whole time, isn't it?
I think so, yeah. It's there the whole time, and we just didn't quite notice.
And this has some scary ramifications, I think. If in building these things they work, how might that change all of us too? I'm very intrigued by this possibility that I could make one of these in my garage. And I'm not being facetious at all. I think this is or go to my local jeweler and make one. Let's talk about the history of this idea for you. When did you first start looking into this divination tool?
Well, let me first start by saying, you know, that I am a student of the Bible. I'm a seeker just like everyone else. And this whole thing was a big surprise to me that I was going to write this book in the first place. It started about 3 years ago. I wrote a book called Edgar Cayce's Guide to Gemstones, Minerals, Metals, and More that was just released this June. And I was on the show. I talked to George about it. And in the book, it's talking about the man who everyone considers the world's greatest psychic, Edgar Cayce, and all of the life readings that he did where he mentioned gemstones, because I write about gems and minerals and their healing properties. And so how it kind of came about is after the book was already written and it was off to print and everything, people began to give me information about an unknown aspect of the breastplate of the high priest. Because in the Cayce book, I have a whole section on the gems and minerals that were in the Bible. And there was more of them than we really even imagine. And so there's a whole section in there about the breastplate of the priest. Basically, God told Moses that, you know, you will build a tabernacle and you will dress the priests in these certain garments. And one of these garments will include a breastplate that will have 12 stones in it, each one of the stones representing one of the 12 tribes of Israel. And in the Cayce Project, that was just kind of where I left it. And then little by little, people began just out of the blue or whatever, coincidence, synchronicity, if you will, began giving me information about this thing called the Urim and Thummim, which is basically something that was sitting behind the breastplate of the priest. And it is speculated that they could have been stones. And so the priest would reach behind the breastplate. If he needed to speak with God, you know, the priest would go before the Holy of Holies once a year in the tabernacle. And but other than that, if it wasn't that annual pilgrimage to the tabernacle, sometimes they needed to speak with the Creator. So they would basically ask a question, and they would reach behind the breastplate and pull out one of, supposedly, okay, this is all up for speculation and scholarly debate, but they would reach in, and if they pulled out a certain one, then it would answer yes, and if they pulled out the other one, it would answer no. So it was basically some kind of a binary tool or process that the priest used to get a clear answer from the Creator. And then that gets into another whole debate, like is it really a device? And in my book, I'm going to say, just because I want to talk about stones and minerals, I guess I believe that it was maybe two stones or something like that, because the breastplate was already made of stones. But some other scholars surmise that perhaps it could have just been a process, that Urim and Thummim could have been a term used to describe going to speak with God.
All right, and explain that term again, just so people understand it. We don't say it too fast, and it just kind of gets swept away, because it's key on that, and anybody can search for it in their Bible, and it's there.
Yes, this is called the Urim, which is U-R-I-M, and Thummim, which is T-H-U-M-M-I-M, and this is from...
In English, right.
In Hebrew English.
Right, it translated... not transliterated into English, it's Urim and Thummim, just like we would think it is. And so that, and those were very specific things.
They believe that they were, yes, that they would have been perhaps a couple of stones, crystals, stones, minerals, that the priest used to speak with the Creator. And where people can also learn about this is if they've read the book called The Alchemist by Paulo Coelho, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name correctly.
I think you are, as far as I'm concerned. This, I declare it pronounced correctly.
Thank you. This is a beautiful biblical allegory, this book, and it's about a shepherd who travels to Egypt in search of his lost treasure, which is kind of what we're talking about when we take people into the future. He's searching for his purpose. And he runs across a king who wears a breastplate, who hands him the Urim and Thummim and says, if you get into trouble and if you really are in a situation, then use these and they will give you the answers that you seek, you know. And so he uses them during a couple of critical moments in the book, and everything. It's a wonderful book. And so I was given the book and a little visual, I don't know, like I sometimes see little visions. Something just washed over me. I saw this book with a pink cover, and I said, wow, I'm supposed to write about this, you know. And then sure enough, my publisher ended up putting a pinkish-purple cover on the thing.
Did, indeed. And then there's other way, this breastplate idea that the priests would, after they were ritually washed and then dressed, would then don that this breastplate that had, you said, stones in the front as well, that there's almost a model. You could almost kind of follow a design for that based on descriptions in the Bible.
Yes, there is an actual description in Exodus 28:17 that lists the four rows and the stones that are in each one of those four rows. And then there was apparently some onyx that were engraved, and they were worn on their shoulders as well, that apparently had Hebrew letters in them.
Have you priced how much it would cost to make one of those?
I know that when I was writing the Casey book, there's a whole ball of wax that you get into interpreting the stones that are in the breastplate. In the new book, divination of God, I go ahead and I go with the stones that are listed in the King James Version of the Bible. But in the Casey book, I get into some of the scholarly debate that goes on, because geologically and geographically, they don't really know for sure what the true identity of these stones are because of translation and different things. And so I ended up contacting the Temple Institute in Jerusalem to ask them. I did a lot of research on what different groups were saying the identity of the stones were, and I really liked what they had to say. And I, on their website, if people look up, if you just Google, like, the Temple Institute, you can get on there and you'll see a picture of their recreation of the breastplate.
I wonder how much it cost them. And I wonder how much it would I wonder how much it would cost any of us to have one made and actually try using it.
They claim it. They took years, you know, to build this thing in it, and donations, and I don't know. It may be on there.
I mean, some of the stones that are mentioned don't sound like they'd be that expensive. Some of them are, obviously, but others of the ones that you list in the book, Divination of God, don't appear to be that much. So, I mean, I think you could, theoretically, you could build such a thing. And I was intrigued by the idea that some people claim that for a yes or a no answer from God, it wasn't just which stone you might have picked, but also how stones would have lit up.
Yeah, there's some debate as to maybe they illuminated, and maybe the onyx on the shoulders, they potentially also illuminated with different letters in the Hebrew alphabet that they would use for divinatory purposes.
So it would be, one would light up to mean yes, and the other would light up to mean no, if you asked a yes or no question of God.
Correct.
Wow. I mean, it's a fascinating idea. I'd love, wouldn't it be cool if somebody built one?
It would be really cool. In fact, Edgar Casey did a lot of readings on this in his lifetime, and there was a woman who went to Edgar Casey to ask if such a machine could be built. And he basically told her, you know, hey, the process is more important than the machine itself.
Well, and I think that's all very mystical and all, and I think that there's some truth to that. But if you could build it, I mean, it would seem worth it to do that. And then if in the end the process was more important, that's fine. But gosh, who knows until you build it whether or not it would actually work?
Yeah, there's I picked up a book called Urim Thummim God. It is a fiction book, and it's kind of like a Raiders of the Lost Ark kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't get to read the whole thing because I was in the process of research, but it's talking about, yeah, exactly what you're talking about. Like, they kind of go on the quest to find it and to build it and all that kind of stuff. I really believe that anything we can think about in our imagination, we could probably create.
Well, we'll start there when we come back, Urim and Thummim. And I want you to take us through the story as you tell it about how this was used in Exodus and what, at least at the time, the ancient children of Israel were able to get from this divination tool, this obscure ancient tool of prophecy revealed in the book Divination of God. I can, however, completely endorse what you said about gemstones having healing properties, because at the birth of every one of our children, I put diamond products dangled from my wife's IV rack.
In wow.
And that was very healing. Every time she was having contractions, she'd look up at those little boxes dangling from the IV bag, and they had a healing property to them at the time. She swore every time it helped to get through childbirth looking up at those boxes.
Wow.
So just a little bit. All right, so we'll come back then with Dr. Shelley Kerr, Divination of God, and we'll break it down for you. Just what has happened in the past with this divination tool? What was revealed when it was employed before on Coast to Coast AM? This is Ian Punnett. So just what was this obscure ancient tool of prophecy used for? I mean, what's our record of it being used for? What answers did it give the people in the Bible? We'll talk about that coming up in just a second with Dr. Shelley Kerr. But also, the Book of Mormon. Where is Urim and Thummim in the Book of Mormon, or a deck of tarot cards, for that matter. We'll explore all of those. Plus, Dr. Kerr has been kind enough to step aside for that last hour. We will return to the subject, which we had just gotten started with in the very first hour, on the former Canadian top official, defense minister, and his comments this week on the U.S. and our apparently upcoming, as he predicts, military base on the moon, and all of the conversations that were being started about this intergalactic war, which he is trying to prevent by gathering together a special meeting of the Canadian Parliament. We'll pick up that conversation in our final hour, but more on the divination of God, this obscure ancient tool of prophecy revealed, next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Well, let's start in the book of Exodus for this divination tool, this breastplate. Some people would use it as that sort of a breastplate with these 12 stones representing the 12 tribes of Israel on it. Perhaps it also involved onyx shoulder. What would you call those? Shoulder amulets?
Yeah, amulets,
okay.
I think.
And they may have lit up, yes or no. Is there a name for this other than a breastplate? Was there a name for the actual device itself?
The breastplate was theoretically separate from the Urim and Thummim,
okay,
which were sitting behind it.
Which were behind it.
But then there's the other whole thing that maybe the pieces on the shoulders were also tools that were illuminated. So these could have been like three separate things
that were all tied in together.
But they're theoretically separate.
Now, you've looked into this. You said you talked to some people who studied this, and you've been in contact with experts in Jerusalem. When was the last time something like this was used? Do we know?
Gosh, even in the Bible, there's only a handful of references to this device. So I think that it's, I don't know. I mean, we just
maybe
don't know
thousands of years.
Maybe
thousands of years. But at the same time, who knows, might have been used sometime along the way. We just don't know about it.
We didn't hear about it.
Okay. And there's a reference to it in the Dead Sea Scrolls?
There is, let me see.
I know there's nothing in Nag Hammadi. I think you mentioned that.
Yeah, not Nag Hammadi. And not really, not exactly in the Dead Sea Scrolls. No, I was just...
Nothing in the DSS. Okay.
No. Nope.
But in the, what does it say in the Bible itself? What was the last information that anybody received from this device? What was it about?
Okay.
Take us there.
I'm going to take you there in a nutshell. So this is the chronology, Ian. Okay. First, God told Moses, you will create the Urim and Thummim. And that was all he said. It seems like there was no directions given. It's just as if Moses just knew what that was. Then after the tabernacle was built, when Moses consecrated his brother Aaron into the priesthood, he was directed to place the breastplate with the Urim and Thummim and the other garments on his brother. That's the second time it was mentioned. The third time was when the Lord came to warn Moses about his death, and he was asked to elevate Joshua to just elevate his status among the Israelites. And then the next was when Eleazar the priest was asked to use the Urim to communicate with God, and until he communicated with him, Joshua's full blessing could not take place until he consulted the Urim and Thummim.
And in consulting, it appeared as though, would that have been one of those cases where something was lit up or something was communicated that confirmed what he was asking or his appointment?
Probably like divine favor or something.
Okay.
You know, I thought of something really today earlier, the city of Ur in ancient Babylonia, that was supposedly where Abraham was born. So maybe there's some connection there in the term, like Urim being like the source,
mm-hmm.
you know, like another term for maybe the source. So to me, this means that in order to give Joshua this blessing, we just needed to get God's favor, and that would be demonstrated potentially by a positive lighting up or a positive drawing of lots or however it is that they did this.
Well, and that's the other thing. I mean, a discussion about a drawing of lots, which is interesting because that comes up a couple of times, obviously, in the Bible, and lots of things are decided by lots. But lots are a little different in one sense. I mean, if you're getting an amulet on a breastplate or something like that to light up, it's kind of hard to mistake that. I mean, but the idea of lots, something being decided by lots, that's kind of a game of chance in a way. I mean, it's sort of 1 in 6 chance or something like that might, you know, give you a response or something. But in doing that, you can feel like whichever one you pick is the one that the divine invisible hand of God wanted you to pick, or you could look at that as just it was a roll of the dice and you lost or you won, depending on how you look at that. When you're talking about drawing lots,
right? Some people think it was the stones that were illuminated. Some people think it was just the lots being drawn. I mean,
right?
That's why they just don't really know. I mean, and then how the lots get drawn? I mean, like you said, it's kind of like a little gambling there.
Right. I mean, as I understood lots, and it was, you know, it might be two names, you know, it might say Shelley and Ian, and those would be two of the lots. And then the other two lots might say goes or stays. And you would pick one name, and so you pick Shelley, and then you might pick another lot that says stays. And so that would be the divine message that said you stay. And if it had gone the other way, then I would have stayed or gone or something like that. You know what I mean? So, I mean, that's how I understood it. So how does this play into the Book of Mormon?
Yeah, this is really interesting. When Joseph Smith was visited in his home, basically in 1823, he was a spiritual seeker. He wanted to have a higher understanding of Christianity, and so he prayed to God, and in 1823, an angel named Moroni appeared in his bedroom and told him to go up to a hill and unbury some golden plates. And so basically, in the Book of Mormon, it's documented that he used something called the Urim and Thummim, which he described as almost like spectacles, like maybe they had the crystal, round crystals in them, but they were attached by a silver bow, almost like a little pair of glasses. And he looked through these, and by looking through them, he supposedly was able to translate this ancient, very obscure text. And so he was able to use them to translate the Book of Mormon into English.
Using that device?
Using what he calls the Urim and Thummim.
Okay, but that seems contrary to what we had originally thought it was. Now it sounds almost like, you know, like it's some sort of spy tool or something, to like a decoder ring or something.
Yeah, they describe it in different Mormon texts. Maybe they were crystals, but yet because of the way he described they were attached together, they seem to be like spectacles. That's my understanding of them. So yeah, and that he would put them, he would look through them, but he would be like bending over and looking into a hat.
How about that?
Okay. So that, I mean, maybe to darken the eyes. You know, there's that whole, that could come maybe from the ancient Greeks who did a lot of scrying, you know, or crystal ball gazing or whatever, where you have to cover your head with a darkened cloth so that you can see things in the crystals. And so maybe something like that was going on.
Kind of like how the referees in the NFL have to do that on the instant replay on the sideline. They look into the camera, they put that little thing over their heads.
That's right.
Yeah, just
exactly like that.
That's where it all started. And then, so that's a reference to that, but we don't, like Mormons, as far as your research on this, they haven't built another one of these devices, or they don't keep Urim and Thummim stones around and still use them?
No, there was that, there were several witnesses who actually signed off to say they witnessed the golden plates and they saw them with their own eyes, but there are no witnesses who actually saw the Urim and Thummim. It's just spoken about, but if you talk to any Mormon, they will definitely know about it because it's written in all of their scriptures.
All right. And then how does this work its way into a deck of tarot cards?
Well, what the whole thing is, when I'm writing a book, I'm kind of like an, I feel like an investigator, you know, and so I'm looking around going, where, what is the source of this Urim and Thummim? And so just in my research, I started looking at a couple of the different cards that are in the tarot, one being the High Priestess that has the card has pillars on it of black and white. And so it just kind of reminded me of that binary black-white tool that could be the Urim and Thummim. And the other one was the Chariot, which there was something I read where they were talking about in the Chariot card, which is in the Major Arcana, there are these two moons that sit on top of the charioteer's shoulders, and one is happy and one's unhappy. And so it kind of reminded me of the energy of the Urim and Thummim. And so I had the opportunity to talk to a tarot scholar who actually told me, which I didn't realize, that the tarot was actually developed in the early 1400s before the Renaissance began, but right after the height of the Dark Ages. And then the images were actually from the Catholic Church at that time. And it wasn't until the 1700s that the deck was actually revised to include the more occultized images that are basically, you know, linked to ancient Egypt and the Rosicrucians and all that, because they thought it would seem more mystical, but that the origins of the tarot actually are in the Catholic Church. And so because of that, then the images that I was assuming were like Urim and Thummim, initially I thought, well, then they really must not have initially come from that.
Right.
Then I started looking into Freemasonry. And apparently in the 13th, 14th, and 21st degrees in the rituals there, they talk about how the Urim and Thummim could have been part of the recovered artifacts that were taken from King Solomon's temple. And there's a legend that said that these Urim and Thummim and other items were actually returned to the treasury. And so, you know, it just, the mystery continues.
Well, I've heard this argument about tarot before, and I have, or I guess, am I mispronouncing it? It should be tarot, like Ross
tarot,
Ross tarot. And I've had a reading done by somebody who is an Old Testament scholar at a well-known university, where he has been studying tarot and how, or tarot, and he's been studying it as part of the ancient but lost divination tool used by, at one point, as you point out, predominantly the Christian church. And so he goes into it and he explains, only if you know kind of the origin of some of these references, some of these church references, do you understand all of the figures that are on the tarot cards or tarot cards. And he went through and he did a tarot reading for me, and then about, I mean, it was just awful. Apparently, I was like going to die the next day. I mean, it was like every card he turned over got worse. And he was like, even checking the cards, and he's like, I'm really sorry about this, but you know, all these horrible things, all these calamities were supposed to happen to me according to the cards. And fortunately, they didn't, and everything, my life's golden. But this was only about 2 years ago. But at the same time, I had somebody else do a reading for me like about a week later, who also studied this from a religious perspective, and they came up with these, you know, great cards or much better cards saying that my life was going to be great. So you just kind of like never know that, but they all made the same comment that you did, that there's lost symbolism in the imagery of these cards, and we really ultimately don't know what a lot of them tie into, although we can make a lot of suppositions, and you can, as you're doing, sort of draw some connections.
Yeah, I wanted to find out, like, are there any tarot decks out there that are representative of some of the ancient ones? And I was told that maybe the Morgan Greer deck is the closest thing that we have to that.
Okay.
And that if we go to Italy, now the next time, I've been in Italy before, but if I go there again, that I should go up and we should talk to some Italian people and ask them about the tarot, and what they will tell you is that it is a game.
Right.
And if you say, well, you use that to tell the future, well, yeah, but it's just a game.
Right.
You know? And so they use it in that kind of spirit. So
Well, yes. in one of my readings, I won, and the other reading, I lost the game, apparently. All right, so Dr. Shelley Kerr, who is currently one of the world's leading authorities on energy healing and mind-body medicine, the new book is Divination of God, the Obscure Ancient Tool of Prophecy Revealed. We've been talking about this breastplate and these connecting stones and how they might be used. And when was the last time they were used? I'm really intrigued by the idea that somebody could build this and then test it. I mean, why not? It doesn't seem that hard. We can't, you know, we may never find the lost ark in our lifetime, but we could make one of these and seemingly follow a prescription or a design that was left for us by the ancients on this.
In the book, at the end of the book, I suggest some materials that we can use to do this very affordably without having to go build a big contraption.
Okay, go ahead.
I was guided to these. Well, in the whole bottom line is I'm trying to trace the origins to it, and I really think that it goes back to ancient Egypt because there is evidence that the priests there wore breastplates. And so I'm guided to these materials that are basically hand-carved scarab beetles from Egypt. One is made of Egyptian basalt and the other of the white soapstone. And you just can put them in a bag and you can just do the same thing, like yes or no. And then when you reach in, you pull out the black one, it means no. You pull out the white one, it means yes. And so this seems to be a very simplified solution to that, how we can use this ourselves.
Well, and that's good, but I still want that. I still am dying to see whether you could ever devise something where the stones would light up. I mean, that's the part that you can do that, and we could say yes or no, and we can get our answers that way. And, okay, it's a little bit like a toss of a coin, you know, just sort
right.
of saying God, heads or tails, God, and then whatever it lands to, say thank you, God, and that's our answer. But, I mean, you cannot mistake if one of these stones actually lights up. I mean, that would change everything, wouldn't it?
You're right.
Yeah.
We've got to figure this out, Ian.
Well, I love the challenge of it. So I tell you what we're going to do, too. We'll take some calls. We'll give the numbers out coming up at the top of the hour. And we'll stay with this for a little while. I'm a little bit worried about something, and I'm just putting you on notice on this up front so that you don't feel like this is anything that has anything to do with you. But once we give the number, we start taking calls. I'm going to weed out everybody that may be calling about this other story we've been talking about from Canada. And as long as I can weed them out, I will. But we may be overcome by them. So we'll take as many calls as we can coming up in the time ahead. And then we just may end up having to surrender to the energy of that other topic. And that may be something we may or may not be able to get back to. Where does somebody get a copy of your book?
They can get it on my website at galactichealing.org. Some of my other books are available on the Filament eBook Club by going to filamentbooks.com. They can get the Divination book at amazon.com and Barnes & Noble.
Okay, and you can link up to it at coasttocoastam.com and go from there. Dr. Shelley Kerr on this tool, this ancient tool. And you can follow in the chapters how you might build one or with the information that's there. And she goes through the story, as it's told in the book of Exodus, of how this works. And we'll get back to this and more. We'll start taking your calls coming up soon, I know, on the subject of the former Canadian defense minister and his comments about American intergalactic war. What we're starting, which he's trying to stop. More on that coming up on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.